This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. Neil Conan is away. The symbols of our quest for the divine are everywhere. We've built churches, written prayer books, and sung hymns. But for some, the way toward intimacy with God is silent, a life spent in contemplation and quiet community. In the 11th century, the Carthusian monks chose just such a life, a rigorous, ascetic lifestyle, wearing hair shirts, eating no meat, avoiding eye contact, waking in the middle of the night, each night, to pray. Amazingly, the Carthusian lifestyle remained the same for hundreds of years, surviving nearly intact until the Second Vatican Council. Nancy Klein McGuire, a Renaissance scholar, examined this living museum, following the lives of five young men who entered this religious order. She collected her remarkable investigative work into a new book, An Infinity of Little Hours. It is a world from which many of us would recoil, a world stripped to its essentials, to thought and prayer. As the men work, pray, and live in solitude, they make their way toward God. But it is not, as you will hear, an easy journey. This hour will examine the contemplative life, how and why modern young men pursue an 11th century ideal, and what that ideal means in the 21st century. Later in the hour, our regular Monday feature, the opinion page, conservative views on the Bush presidency. But first, the contemplative life. Have you ever longed to cloister yourself, either in a convent, an ashram, or a monastery? How do you feel about withdrawing from the world? Is it the ultimate act of purity and sacrifice, or is it essentially selfish? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And I'm joined by Nancy Klein McGuire. Her book is called An Infinity of Little Hours. And she's here in Studio 3A. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
This is an order, I think it's fair to say, that many Catholics might not even know about. They don't recruit. They certainly don't put up those billboards on the highway that we sometimes see that say, you know, God's calling, will you answer? So how did you know about this order, and how were you able to get so close?
With great difficulty. As anyone who reads the book knows, I am married to a ex-Carthusian monk, and that would make it seem like it was a slam dunk. But it wasn't, partly because I didn't want to hear about it for a long time. Just did not want him to talk about it.
Well, at least you knew he wasn't chasing chicks. I mean, so why didn't you want to hear about it?
Well,
you knew where he was.
I knew where he was, but on our honeymoon, he insisted on taking me to visit Parkminster. And as when you read the book over and over, you read about this long, winding driveway leading to the monastery. So 3 days after we're married, we're going down this long, winding road, and a brother comes out from the monastery and says, "I knew you'd come back." That was one bad move. The second bad move, we go into this place called the North Parlor, which is cold, damp, unbelievably uncomfortable furniture. And the prior at the time, Dom Guy, who had an Oxford boom so loud I couldn't even understand him, came in, and his vicar. And of course I said, "Well, I want to see the place after I've come all this way." And he said, "Absolutely not. Women are not allowed. Queen Victoria needed a letter from the Pope to get in there." So that was a second strike. I mean, I'd had enough of this monastery life. So for 30 years, it was just on hold. We didn't speak of it.
So what changed your mind, and why were you drawn to this project after all that?
Well, as a 17th century scholar, for 20 years, I was obsessed with the execution of Charles I, the King of England. I wanted to be on the scaffold. I wanted to see how the crowd reacted. I wanted to know how they smelled. I wanted to know how they felt. And, yeah, obviously I couldn't do it. But then I found that I could actually get inside the 11th century, which was way off my target. But I found out by just general research that the Carthusian order, as you already said, for 1,000 years didn't change. And nobody had explored it. It was a scholar's dream. And you know, I was hooked. I was determined to find whatever it took, whatever it cost, I was going to find out the secret of those monks.
So was your husband helpful? Did he forgive you for being so indifferent to this for so many years of your marriage?
The most helpful thing he did was to tell me, it's impossible for anyone to capture the texture and the life in the Charter House. And that, for me, has always been a good incentive when people say something's impossible. He just thought it couldn't be done. So I hit the Library of Congress.
And you said, I'll show you.
You bet. And he frankly didn't remember many details. He remembered that he loved being in cell. And he remembered the Monday walk. But I had 10,000 words by that time, and I clearly had hit bottom because the Library of Congress was exhausted. He was exhausted. So a colleague at the library suggested that I start finding other ex-monks. And that was a real challenge because once a Carthusian, always a Carthusian, like the Marines, and they're very private and very secretive. So I started out with one monk that I knew, or had known. I didn't know him, but I knew his name and I tracked him down. And so it was sort of one by one until I got to Dom Ignatius, the German monk, who actually had kept track day by day of what happened in the monastery. So tons of names. And then it's internet phone calls.
It's investigative reporting from
that
standpoint.
That's right. I'm just trying to track him down.
You followed five young men who joined the order in the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. Why did they want to join?
Anyone, first of all, these came from pretty privileged backgrounds. I mean, these weren't people who couldn't do anything else. They were very talented and skilled. There's no reason to join the Carthusian unless you really passionately want to have a personal relationship with God, you know, while you're still on earth. And that's the driving force. And I think some of them get there. There's a good example in the book of a man who describes his experience of God. And he ends his description with saying, and then I could only say, ah, ah. He just didn't have words to explain it. All of them obviously don't get there, but some do. One of the young men read the Bible. Bible's big reading, obviously, in a monastery. And he read about how Moses, when he came down from the mountain after getting the Ten Commandments, his face was in a glow, is the way the Bible translates it. And so he went around looking at the old monks, and he thought, aha, they've got a glow. They've made it. So he thought that, you know, in 40, 50 years, he might make it too.
Your book really exploded some misconceptions that I had about the monastery life. For example, you described monks living in cells, and I thought it meant, you know, a cell. I mean, I'm sorry, I was kind of an urban street reporter for a number of years, so cell means something specific to me. And but in fact, these were like little townhouses. They each had it wasn't just one horrible room, but there was a room. They had a workroom. They had a place to offer their own private devotions. Mm-hmm. Very austere, but not horrible.
No, 1,500 square feet. Think of what that would cost in New York, plus a 1,200 square foot garden. There weren't couches and recliners in the cell, but there was a lot of space. And that's what is called a cell. But the trick of it is, you think, well, yeah, this is a pretty good deal. But they're in there 24/7, only allowed out three times a day to go to church. Once in the middle of the night from about 11 o'clock till 2 and 2:30. So their sleep is always broken.
Oh, and when you say allowed out, is that part of the devotional to voluntarily not leave? Is that part of the discipline? Or are they literally locked in?
No, there's a lock on the door, so no one else can come in. So no one else can come in. But they could go out. But the Carthusians are modeled on the early desert fathers, St. Anthony of the Desert. And they call themselves the desert. And the whole point is to be alone for two reasons. One, to go into inner space, as the astronauts would go into outer space. They have to learn who they are, or they can't tolerate it, because they're all alone in this cell. As Patty says, there's nobody here but me and hopefully God. So they're living with themselves all the time. And there's no stimulation, no radio, no TV, no letters from home.
They can read, though.
Yes.
What do they read? I'm assuming no Time or Newsweek.
No, absolutely.
No Economist.
No secular newspapers, no religious magazines.
Not even any religious magazines.
No. The novice is confined to what the novice master gives him to read. So he doesn't go to this incredible library that the monastery has. It's a fabulous library. But a novice is never allowed in the library.
And even the letters from home are read before they are handed over. Why is that?
It's interesting, because the novice master did give Don Malachy a Christmas card from the girl he had met on the way over. It's a tradition in all religious orders. The letters going out are also read. The novice will, no monk will ever cover up his, will seal his envelope. It's part of privacy.
We're talking about the contemplative life this hour, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Michelle Martin. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington. We're talking with Nancy Klein McGuire this hour about her book, An Infinity of Little Hours, which follows five young men as they journey through the life of the Carthusian Monastic Order, the most austere religious group in the Western world. If you have questions about the monastic life, or if you have ever lived a similarly ascetic spiritual life, give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Before the break, we were talking about the austerity of the life. So no outside media, of course, no radio, certainly not, no television. But what about hot water?
No. No electricity, no general heating, no flush toilet. There's like the equivalent of an Essex drum that they kind of build a fire with. They, in their workshop, they chop up pieces of wood and use coal. So what they call the main room where their bed is, they can keep warm. But the spirit of the order is the less coal you use, the farther you are to being a holy person. So they tend not to keep the room warm.
Doesn't anybody get sick?
Yes, they do get sick. They get very, very sick. The trick of being, the trick of being a Carthusian monk, you've got to have balance. You can't endure a life where you have one meal a day. You never, ever, ever, ever have any meat. Even if you were dying, you couldn't have any meat. You have a 48-hour fast from Thursday noon until Saturday noon.
Not just for Lent, but every all year long.
Every single day. Every single week. Every single week. So the successful monk cuts himself some slack. He lets his roommate, maybe 50 degrees or something, but the novices are so, they want to get there fast, and they figure the more their hair shirts. So we're hair shirts, and one monk who didn't have too much balance tied his hair shirt so tight that the hair shirt rope was filled with hair and skin and everything else, you know, whereas the monks who kept themselves warm and let their hair shirts loose, you know, survived.
I'm not sure what everybody knows what a hair shirt is.
Okay.
And you're not talking about, like, fashionable pony skin that you could buy on
no.
The Neiman's sale.
The brothers, who are the equivalent of servants in the monastery, make these. And it's like a burlap sandwich thing like people advertise on. And the brothers weave into the burlap just strands of horse's hair.
And what's the purpose? If the purpose is to be uncomfortable.
To irritate the skin.
Why?
The theory is to make you go, and I haven't been there, so I'm just saying what I understand. The theory is to make you go deeper into yourself. If you're totally uncomfortable, and most of them got used to it, you know, and On their long walks, they sweat so much they didn't even feel the hair shirt. But the hair shirt is worn all the time except for their bath every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks, they take a bath and get clean clothes.
I think people will have heard that expression in, oh, don't put on your hair shirt. And I guess that's where it comes from.
Yes. Yeah.
And tell me about the silence. I must tell you that this would be my idea of living hell, not being able to to speak during meals.
Yeah.
But the silence is essential to the experience.
It's the signature of the Carthusian order. It's not just silence. The Trappists don't talk, but they don't live in houses by themselves. It's solitude. They don't even see each other. If they're going to church, they're very careful not to make eye contact with another monk. So the solitude sort of encloses them, and the hoods are always, they have a hood on top of their hat, but it's always up, so you don't see their face.
And the purpose of the silence, again, is what?
The purpose of the silence is to keep them engaged inwardly, so they're not distracted by other things. They're supposed to be constantly praying or meditating. And the silence is part of that. I think very, very few people can pull that off. Most of them who left because of the solitude. That's, you know, the 4 years, they're fine, but it's going into the fifth year, about to make solemn profession, which ties them to this forever. They can't cope with it. Even though they want to stay, they just can't cope. And they have a nervous breakdown or get sick or something.
Let's go to a caller. Here's David in Portland, Oregon. David, what's your question?
Hi. I'm an ex-Franciscan monk, and we lived in a relative solitude. Some of the brothers taught at a nearby university, but most of us, it was pray, work, eat, you know, pray, work, eat, pray, work, eat. And I guess my question is, when I went into the order, I stayed for about a year and a half. I was the first one to leave out of the group of 10 men that went in with me. And I found out several years later, I just ran into one of the men that I was had been in there with, and he said that everyone had left with the exception of one, and I found out several years later that that one had actually gone on to receive holy orders. And I just wondered, is that 90% kind of across the board in all monastic orders, say like the Benedictines and the Trappists, as well as the Carthusians or so on? And I'll just take my answer off the air.
No, David, stay with us if you don't mind.
Oh, sure, okay.
In the Carthusian order, after solemn profession has been made, and at this time it was 5 years of training, there's a 90% perseverance rate. Now, this is before Vatican II. Post-Vatican II, the charter house that I talk about in the order was built for 100 monks. 100 monks were living there at the turn of the century. In 1999, there were 12 monks. So I think the demographics are not good generally in monastic life. the monks who are there are getting older and older. New people come in. There's a huge number of people coming in, but they don't stay. They might stay a year, they might stay 2 years, and then they leave. They don't make it to what, as you well know, is called solemn profession.
Right, and I didn't make it there either.
David, may I ask, why were you drawn to that life?
Well, I was a convert to Catholicism when I was in college, and always felt drawn towards some kind of vocation, priestly or monastic vocation. And, you know, I was really influenced by Thomas Merton's The Seven Story
yes.
Mountain, and his description of the Cistercian life. And I visited the Cistercians, which is a strict form of Benedictine order. But I found it a little bit too confining. There was too much silence. I guess when I went there on a retreat, I kept hearing everything bouncing around in my head for the first week. And it was, I think, I just thought, I just can't deal with this degree of silence in contemplative life. I wanted something where there was a little bit more contact with the outside world. So that's why I chose the Franciscan Order. And the Franciscan Order is huge, and there are so many opportunities for different kinds of service.
David, thank you so much for calling.
Sure, thank you.
Nancy, what is the purpose of the contemplative life? What is its purpose for the individual? What is its purpose for the community? And what is its purpose for God?
The best example I can give of that is very environmental, but I'm a strict environmentalist. And I'm sure you've all heard of loons from the movie with... I've forgotten. There's a movie that opens with loons. Also, my brother Tom Klein wrote a magnificent book on loon magic, so I'm well aware of loons. The loons are protectors of the wilderness. When you stop hearing loons, you know the wilderness has receded, and that part of the earth has been lost to the wilderness. And if you care about wilderness, loons become important. You don't need a lot of loons, but you need enough to know that the wilderness is still there. I see monks like loons. You don't need a whole lot of these contemplative monks, but they guard the human spirit in terms of, yes, that is part of human nature, to have a spiritual life. They're evidence of the spiritual life of man. And even Kierkegaard, who is not a Catholic and not a monk, says, we therefore need monks out there like a navigational buoy at sea in order to see where we are. They don't do anything.
They don't cook their own food. In fact, an order of lay brothers prepares their food and all their clothing.
Yes, it's a posh life.
Except for the no hot water thing.
Well, yes, but every 2 weeks, the brothers spend the entire day boiling hot water, so each of them gets a hot bath, a half-hour hot bath. And for that half hour, they take off their hair shirts and feel a sensuous pleasure in not having the hair shirt on.
All their material needs are taken care of.
Absolutely. They're grub-staked to everything. They're just supposed to stay in their cell, pray, meditate, and twice a day do manual labor. And they can do whatever they want.
I'm going to go to another caller, but I have a quick question for you. One of the things that distinguishes this order is that the men get up in the middle of the night, every
yes.
night. Forgive me, I know this is a ridiculous question, but how do they know when to get up, since nobody is allowed to have a watch
no.
or an alarm clock? How do they know when to get up?
I think this is really cool. One of them is called an excitator, and it has to be a very responsible monk, and he had a wind-up alarm clock. So he would awake with his wind-up alarm clock and go from cell to cell and pull a rope outside the cell, which was, the bell was right above the bed of the monk, so you wake up like this cowbell ringing above you, and then next to the monk's bed there's a board, and the monk pounds on the board so the excitator, or the waker, knows he's awake, and then he goes to the next monk. I love the word excitator. I think it's
excitator. Cool. Oh, it's okay. So it's like the exciter.
That's right.
Get everybody up. Okay.
Start the ball rolling.
I would be the excitator. How do you say it again?
Excitator.
Excitator of my household. Or
maybe
my 2-year-old is the excitator of the household. She seems to be the person who kind of gets us all up. We need to take a short break just to say that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I think we're going to take another caller. Let's go to Gabriel in... Gabriel, how is it? Is it Dyer, Tennessee?
That is correct, miss. It's Dyer, Tennessee.
So, Gabriel, welcome.
Thank you.
What's
Thanks
on your mind?
On the show. I guess my question was, wouldn't it be more beneficial to have these monks out kind of in the field, so to say, performing missionary-style work and actually helping others to kind of, not so much that they're not making a difference in the world, but, to kind of make an impact as far as, being out there, going to starving nations and actually dealing with, kind of the real traumatic things that people could really use the Lord for or their God or whatever it is that they see?
It's a good question, and it seems very practical. But some people sort of have to do this. The average person couldn't do it. I would probably be one of those who lasted about half an hour and said, let me out of here. I think it's a calling, and I believe they would say they don't pray for other people, which would be the easy answer to your question. But by paying attention to God, they make up for all the people who aren't paying attention to God. So in that sense, they're interceding for the human race, but their purpose isn't to go there and pray for other people. Their purpose is to get to God. And there are not many of them. Right now there are 13 houses of Carthusians, monks in the world, and in the 17th century there were 195.
Gabriel, does that answer your question?
Not really.
Yes, it does. Thank you very much. No,
okay.
It does, actually.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What they are allowed to speak to each other sometimes.
Yes.
And what language do they speak? Well, first of all, when are they allowed to speak to each other? Under what circumstances? And what language do they speak?
They speak Latin all the time in their classes, in whatever communication they would have in their ordinary life. They don't do sign language. They speak as much to the point and as shortly as they can in Latin. Okay? But twice a week they talk. The novices, after their classes with the novice master, have an entire hour where they all get together in a group and talk. It's like a cocktail party. And what's so strange to me is for people who choose a life of silence, they just talk all the time. I mean, it's incredible how much they talk. They just can't keep quiet. They're fighting to get in, to get in the conversation. The other time, that's the only time they talk together as a group where they can have an audience. And most of these guys really wanted an audience. The bigger chance to talk, it's really not an intimate scale. Once a week, they go for a walk. I asked the prior, I said, why are you taking a walk? That sounds like fun, And he said, if we didn't, they would all go bonkers. But
a practical man.
Yes, he is.
And the services are all held in Latin.
Correct.
You were kind enough to bring us a CD with some of the chanting in Latin. Will you
right.
tell us about it briefly?
Okay, what you're going to hear
And
is
chanting the right word?
Chanting is precisely the right word. What you're going to hear is what's sung between probably, it depends on the monastery, 11:30 and 2:30. It's called Night Office, and it comprises Matins and Lauds. And you're going to hear the introduction to Matins.
Okay, let's listen.
Domine laudetur. Domine labia mea perius, etos meum annunciavi laudentur.
You're listening to a CD of chanting of the Carthusian monks, and we have been speaking with Nancy Klein McGuire, the author of An Infinity of Little Hours, a book about a the rigorous Carthusian order. Nancy, so much to talk about. It's been a wonderful experience talking about the contemplative life. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm delighted to have been here. It's been great fun.
Ecce benedicite Domino, omne servi Domini, Christatis in Domino Domino, in Atris Domus Dei.